Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things, the show that comes after Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main.
Yo.
Ryan y'all
Brush
people.
We're professionals.
He doesn't appreciate people who interrupt him, but I do it anyway because we have a deep love and respect for each other.
Yo. Sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Brian.
I'm sorry. If there's one thing I hate
Robert Young, everybody.
Hey, I interrupted Brian like he interrupted Andrew, and lo, the cycle of violence continues.
Hey, man. So during the show, I don't know why it didn't occur to me to mention anything, but tomorrow night I'm going to be on a little bit of the national TV. I did a thing for Penn and Teller's Fool Us, and it seemed to go well. And what's funny is I didn't know whether or not I should promote it, partly because I signed a piece of paper saying I would keep my mouth shut up until it was appropriate to, you know, say anything. But then everyone else started saying things. Then the show came out, and then I was in the promo. I was like, okay, so I guess I can start.
Yeah, when you're in TV Guide and it put your name there, you're allowed to say
that. Right. But now there's the second level of like, well, can I say how well it went? Am I allowed to?
No, not until the show airs. That's obvious.
Right. But maybe can I talk about how I felt through the experience? Or does that only become apparent after the show?
Wait till after the show airs.
Right. So anyway, so my default option has been to keep my mouth shut. But I did go back and watch a bunch of other episodes of Penn and Teller's Fool Us. And made me really excited about my short segment on there, like seeing the way the U.S. edition of the show treats everyone else.
They handle magic wonderfully well. They do a very good job of it.
And once I saw that, I was like, okay, I could feel really good about telling the world that this is happening. And I'm not gonna say anything else than that. I'm done. There are things I'll say later after it actually airs.
Man, and they have a hell of a lineup this year. They've had a bunch of great magicians, and I know because having spent, however many years since iTricks began in the magic field of coverage, and having befriended virtually all of magic on Facebook, it is literally just one wave of people that I know on Facebook after another. And they are all great names. They're all amazing, fantastic names that very much deserve the recognition. And I am very glad to see you among them, Brian.
Dude, I'm really excited about it. Separate from that, you know, you guys tell me if you don't want to bring this into the After Things discussion, but magic is a very tricky profession insofar as there's a culture inside.
It's very deceiving, Brian.
It is highly deceptive. No. I don't know. I'm getting the vibe that you guys don't
want
to go.
No, we do want you to go. We're just teasing you because you said magic is a tricky profession.
You said tricky. And okay. Like, because it involves tricks.
What I'm saying is it's tricky to rock a rhyme. To rock a rhyme that's right on time. It's tricky. So one of the things I did was I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if there was a better way for me to do it or whatever. But recently, I went on to a magic online forum. Because here's the thing. The internet is wonderful. People all jump on the internet.
You're not filled with enough self-loathing.
No, that's any place I go is filled with self-loathing, right? But it's like magicians want the benefit of sharing information with each other. However, magicians also have the difficult position of not having been grown up in a field where secrecy is paramount, right? So it's like, let's say you had an online forum for magicians to interact and say, hey, this trick is good, that trick's not good. Here's a variation I do that would be helpful to you and blah, 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 blah. How does something like that exist in a world where ostensibly everybody looks to the outward-facing public and says, no, magic is secrecy, and we never talk about these things when... I mean, clearly you do. You talk about them to each other, and you do it in a forum that anyone can sign up and take a look at.
Well, you know, in magic, we use code words, too, you know, when we want to talk about things. Like, oh, well, I did the B-switch using a TT. You know.
Okay, fair enough.
I was actually going to say TT. TT is always the one that I
that I
see around of like, oh yeah, no, I think that he, yeah, it's very easy when you think of it in terms of a TT.
Mm-hmm. Or an NW, you know. So yeah, I mean, that's obviously like, you know, we tend to use these code words and stuff. And there are categories of magic effects, by the way, which are not discussed on the internet that are you know, you get somebody to develop something that's very, very limited, very, very exclusive. And, you know, part of the agreement when you buy this or learn the secret is like, we don't talk about it on the internet. You do not mention this method. You don't mention how this thing works or whatever, because if you spend $800 on something, you don't want somebody to be able to do a Google search and then find out, you know, what that is.
And that's a pretty good example of exactly what I wanted to ask you guys is, there are people on the online forums, and possibly rightly so, who accuse me of hypocrisy because, you know, Scam School is a show all about teaching people how to do magic. You know, if you do that show that teaches people magic, and again, for those of you who don't know, I recorded a video on it, but there are three questions I ask for everything on Scam School. Is it beginner level appropriate? Can you learn it this morning and perform it this night? Second thing, can you do it without ever setting foot into a magic shop or buying anything? Can you make it in your garage right now? And third, is there a single living individual who owns the rights to it? And assuming it passes those three tests, it'll be considered to go on, right? On this forum, people say, how does somebody like you who teaches other people's magic, and again, that's true to the extent that those people are dead and that the secret is 100 years old, how does somebody like you not be a hypocrite by charging for your new stuff? And so, you know, and it caused a moment of self-reflection for me where I had to evaluate, like, why? I mean, the reason is because there's three rules. And number one, you know, is it something you can learn today and do tonight? No. You know, is there a living individual that owns the rights? No. You know, is or I guess, yes. There is, which keeps me from doing it. And then, the magic shop, like, technically, you know, you could make it all yourself, but it would take you 3 months and cost you $1,000. Like, here's my question, is it possible that in the world of magic, we're actually doing more harm than good by holding up the principle of secrecy, full stop? And the reason for this being, I understand that we all say secrecy, you know, in my mind, what we're doing is we are selling wonder. We are selling brief and fleeting and powerful moments of astonishment. And with that in mind, I want those moments to be as good and as powerful and as strong as possible. And I will do whatever it takes to make that happen. Now, in that regard, wouldn't you be able to create more moments of astonishment of greater intensity and greater artistic quality if you had more magicians competing against each other? And what I mean by that is, in the 1950s, you had a flood of cheap plastic electric guitars, and 10 years later, you got the Who, you got the Beatles, you got Led Zeppelin. That was the result of the tools being open to anyone. And my question to you guys is it possible that this veneration of secrecy in some way possibly harms magic as an art?
I don't know how to answer that question. I can certainly say that specifically there are certain kinds of material that if you're a professional, you kind of want to keep out of the hands of the amateur because it makes it more special when you do it. In the hands of an amateur, it can be done poorly and then it is not as effective. But then again, you know, it depends. It's like, forget TV for a moment. Forget those environments and stuff like that. You know, David Blaine took stuff that we'd, you know, that was magic shop, the top selling items in a magic shop, and did an amazing first TV special because
dime store crap is, I believe, the phrase I used when I was a senior in college at the time.
But it was amazing. I mean, he did a great job because most people hadn't seen it. But when you're a corporate magician and you're a corporate guy and you're a guy that's trying to get a higher paycheck per show or whatever, and you're competing against other people like that, there is this sort of, well, I would rather buy this secret or method from somebody than somebody else. I would rather have this sort of have the rights to this material, much like comedy writing or things like that. Like, I want to be able to use these jokes that I got permission from as opposed to everybody being able to do it. And case by case, it depends. It's highly, highly variable. You know, I think that at a certain level as a professional, you're concerned about the idea of certain things being out there because – you know, I have people like I share, you know, they'll teach me some slights and stuff like that, but they don't want everybody else in LA knowing them because if they go to a party or whatever like that, they don't want their competitor, you don't want to find out that their competitor is doing this thing they worked on. You know, in that ecosystem and that competitive marketplace, they're at a disadvantage if the thing they worked on or the thing that they bought the rights to is being seen and done by other people within that system. You know, they're not worried about a guy in Philadelphia doing it, but, you know, it varies.
From my perspective, I don't think in my mind there's much of a question that magic is a bit of a stagnant art form, and that it has not grown at a pace that it should have. I don't know enough about it. I have my own kind of guesses, but I'm not a practitioner. I'm just somebody who has kind of been around things. I don't quite know the solution, but I do know that... you know, what's the Andrew, the smaller the pie, the sharper the knives.
Yeah. Smaller the pie, the sharper the knives, the Kissinger quote.
And I think that that's a part of it, that there is either by perception or reality or the mixture of the two, an idea that magic is a zero sum world. And so you get passions and defense mechanisms that I don't think would be as passionate or as sharp. In a world where people believed that the money or credit for magic was larger than what it is perceived or is in reality right now. And that's where you tend to get, it's not just a disagreement, it's a destruction of the art. And it's not just, you should do that's bad and you did it. It's, you should never be trusted again. You know, like that's, I think sometimes that's where that comes from.
And the any environment where you have the, you know, when you step into a room and you ask yourself, how do these people get here and why are these people here? It's going to be interesting. So I just was at this thing called Thriller Fest, big mystery writer thriller convention in New York City. It's really fun. I got to meet a lot of neat people. Thriller Fest is different than like BoucherCon, which I'll be going to in whatever that is, October or whatever, okay? Thriller Fest is mainly writers. Most of the people there are writers. You know, they're people who are actively writing in the industry. BoucherCon's writers and tons of fans, lots of fans. It's a much, much bigger, you know, different environment. And, you know, if you go to Thriller Fest and you're going to get into conversations with people, it's going to be more professional side, you know, how do I adapt to this marketplace? How do I use social media? How do I do this sort of thing? You know, at a BoucherCon, it might be more like, oh, what are your favorite cozy mysteries? What's your favorite here or whatever kind of stuff. Each environment's going to be different. And then you go to a place, let's say Comic-Con, where 5% of the people there are really content creators and 95% of them are super fans. You know, when you go to places like YouTube or you go to, you know, internet message boards or things like that, you get places, you get where 99% of the people there, they exist to comment and to have opinions on stuff. That is their output. That is what they do.
Right.
And, you know, and they get value by causing a reaction. They get value. They're only going to say something if they can make have it affect somebody else, either a commenter, you're stupid, the writer, you're stupid. I mean, you look at comment threads, like, look at Ain't It Cool News. Look at what the talkbacks have become on there. It is like the...
criticism of Harry Knowles, who, you know, is a complicated individual, but was a pioneer and did amazing things and built an incredibly great site, you know, in what he did. There are people who go there just to make fun of him. They go there just to criticize him. It's not a healthy place. Not a healthy place.
That is where I go whenever I need some acrite on, like, hey, should I put in the effort to do this? Hey, should I answer this email? Like, I go to whatever the most recent Harry Knowles post on Ain't It Cool News, and I look at the comments and I say, oh my God, I need to do everything for the people that Garrett, give a sliver of a rat's ass about anything that we do, because that is what happens when passion goes wrong, man.
And you take a look at, there are parts of the, you know, popular parts of the internet. Like, I don't go to the site Gawker anymore because I just had this epiphany one day. I'm like, it's a really horrible site. I mean, it's a really negative. I mean, it just, you know, they just took down a post, you know, about a guy who, because he was the brother of Geithner, you know, and involved, Geithner, you know, a gay little scandal. They put this guy who's not a public figure at all, but because his last name was with a famous person, they made it a story, you know, and it's like, and it's this need to criticize and tear people apart and all that, you know, and that's
can we real quick I'm going to do kind of a flash forward of what my pick is going to be. I think early on I mentioned in one of the weird things my pick being The Obstacle Is the Way, or Trust Me I'm Lying by Ryan Holiday. And when I read Trust Me I'm Lying, that book starts with essentially promising, hey, I manipulated the media to make American Apparel super famous. I worked on behalf of Max Tucker. These are the tricks that I've done, but I don't recommend you do them. And in my mind is this bold-faced, italicized wink. And then I went on to read the book, and it wasn't until halfway through the book that I realized, oh, wait, no, I think he's serious. I think he genuinely regrets the games that he played back in the past. And I ended Trust Me, I'm Lying, believing in Ryan Holiday. I was like, I think he genuinely believes that the fruits of his labors before were negative and that people shouldn't do it and that there's a better way. I think he genuinely has contempt for cynicism in general. And then I read The Obstacle Is the Way, and I walked away from that book being like, no, this dude's definitely a true believer, and he definitely believes that you need to shut up, work hard, and make good in the world. And it left me, you know, very, very happy. The reason I bring all this up is because he recently has been very outspoken on Twitter in an anti-Gawker way. Yeah, in fact, this whole Gawker story came up because he was the first person I saw trashing Gawker, saying this is what you bought, gentlemen. You know, hope you enjoy it. And it was really, really good. And I don't know how to describe it without getting too deep into it. But my point is that the whole Gawker thing, it's fascinating to hear somebody. Let me put it this way. The angriest people I see in the Gawker thing are people who used to swim in those waters. And Ryan is one of those people who used to swim in those waters. And that is what's fascinating, to watch him on Twitter be the loudest and angriest of voices against Gawker.
Sometimes I find that to be more about, you know, the ex-alcoholic screaming about the temperance movement and why it needs to come to America. Like, I think it's more about them and their own salvation than it is necessarily the best look at where online journalism needs to be in the modern era, or, you know, a true weight of Gawker's soul in terms of, you know, where they need to be. That whole thing was fascinating, and I think what it said as much about us right now, the online readership of websites and news consumption and politics consumption, it said more about as much about us as it did about Gawker. Hopefully it was a evolution of where we are and what that means and what the line of a public figure is. And it's even for Gawker, you know, for Nick Denton, CEO of Gawker, he pulled it. Then his all of his writers, which span over many sites, got upset about it because it was not a decision by them. It was a decision by Nick Denton to pull it. Now, meanwhile, unsaid amongst all this is Nick Denton is currently in court in Tampa, Florida, by Hulk Hogan for posting a sex tape. So what I am sure is in part factoring into Nick Denton's decision to pull the post is, communication either directly or indirectly from the Geithner family to say, listen, this is going to end in a lawsuit, and your culpability for it will depend on whether or not this gets removed right now or not. I agree. I think we've gotten a little bit, into this specific case as opposed to the broader element of understanding and reading what makes you happy and how that affects how you create art on a larger sense. But I think our consumption patterns and what we want and what we like to read about is changing and evolving, and it is reshaping and to the point where, on the initial Gawker post, when I first read it, which, quick side jag, who would have ever thought that the next day people in Ted Cruz's office would be, man, things worked out really well for us with this gay hooker scandal. All the comments were, this is gross and weird, and why'd you post this? And I find little sympathy with the person that you have made your lead unnamed source, to ruin this guy's life. And I think that was very interesting that it didn't look at, hey, look, here's a powerful man who is being laid bare. It was, this is gross, and I feel gross for having read it.
But I'll be back here tomorrow to read whatever else you have to say and go comment and tell you this is gross. That's the problem.
That's certainly the motivation. But do you think that's the reality? Do you think that they are experiencing a positive bump in their viewership?
Oh, I think that post was certainly gigantic. It was huge.
Why we pulled it was huge. And, and I think that it comes down to us. Like, I mean, people are going to do what people are going to do. That's fine. Gawker can cover whatever they want. They have a right to do that. And we'll legally find out, do they have the right to air your sex tape without your permission? Just because you talk about having sex. What's that?
We're going to find out, brother, whether or not Lost Domania is going to run wild.
I'm a real American.
Yeah. I think that, you have to think about, every time we go to those places and we go say, oh, let me click on this. Because one day I had this epiphany. I'm like, this isn't my business. When Bruce Jenner made a very difficult decision and then decided that, Olympic medals are one thing. He's going to do a new frontier and become Caitlyn Jenner. That's great. It's none of my business. It is none of my business, it begins with compassion. Every discussion starts with compassion, ends with compassion. It can be like, does not compute, whatever, but good luck to her and congratulations to her. But it's not my business. I don't need to follow this. I don't need to know this. This person made a decision. And for people who that's important and relevant to, if it helps them come to some conclusion about themselves, that's great. But stuff is just, why should I care?
Speaking of which, my 7-year-old daughter asked me on the way to Ant-Man, essentially it boiled down to her saying, hey, Dad, what's up with boys, getting some kind of surgery and becoming girls and girls having surgery and becoming boys? How's that work? And then, it was fascinating to... First of all, I did my best to be as respectful as possible as I said the words I said, but there was another part of me sitting outside of myself saying like, ha, how are you going to handle this one, Einstein? And, and judging myself as I did my best to explain what does it mean to be a girl and what are things that girls are into? And she described a bunch of stuff what does it mean to be a boy? And her definition of boys are like, they like to push people and shout. I was like, well, imagine if you wanted to be somebody who pushed people and shouted, and yet your body was didn't match your mind and all that stuff. It was a fascinating discussion, and at some I don't know, at some core level, I was so thrilled that this is the kind of discussion I would never in a million years invite upon myself to have with a 7-year-old. But I'm thrilled that braver people than me created a situation where this was an appropriate thing to talk about on our way to Ant-Man. And I don't know. I did my best, but it was fascinating. Just fascinating to see how much has changed.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think that there are some conversations, though, that we still can't have because the way they're perceived, though. So, you know.
Gambling man says, and then we watched Ant-Man.
Yeah. I there are so many discussions that I'm like, I don't have any skin in the game, so I'm not going to publicly talk about it.
I mean, that's fine. I mean, I don't know.
I just want people to be happy. I want everybody to feel loved and compassion. That's my bottom line is that, you know, unless you're a completely evil, awful person who murders and hurts people, that's different. I don't know. But you know, I think everybody, you know, everybody's going through their own little drama I get frustrated by sites that want to shame or do this or do stuff like that. Cause it's like, you know, what does it say about us when we want to go there and say, oh, who screwed up? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For those murderers, they should find cold compassion at the hands of the vigilante Ant-Man. Well, and that's why you should post on magic forums. Da 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 da. Wrapped it up in a bow.
Nicely done, sir.
I have a pick.
Yeah, go. It up.
Go.
My pick. Just escaped my mind.
Is it Name of the Devil, the new Andrew Main novel that my wife just finished and enjoyed very much?
No, it was another one of the movie I watched. I forgot. I hope she liked it. Good. I have Alive by our good friend Scott Sigler.
Oh, heck yeah. No, I just got that too.
Yeah
that and
you guys, you guys have been, you guys are like the best of new book bros, and you're just, it's great. I love it.
Yeah, you know, when you write a book, you're part of a special club.
No. No, you guys are great. I got a pick. I saw Trainwreck with Amy Schumer and directed by Judd Apatow. And how about this for a pick? How about you make a comedy that's under 2 hours, Judd? Huh? Like, you know, it doesn't have to always be 2 hours long.
This is an anti-pick. This is a screw you.
I liked it. I liked it. Right? 2 hours. Long, just really long for a comedy.
Full disclosure, Justin is a co-owner of Trainwreck and the Movie Draft.
Looked like it. I mean, theater was full.
All right, so my pick is tomorrow night, watch Penn & Teller's Fool Us, featuring yours truly, as he attempts to fool Penn & Teller, but he's not really trying to attempt to fool them, because one of them might have been one of the helpers
the routine. We're going to find out. Okay. I think it's... Find out Monday on the CW. Hey, Penn & Teller's Fool Us. Will Brian fool Penn & Teller? Only the CW knows for sure, and they'll disclose it to you with words and pictures tomorrow. CW's Penn & Teller's Fool Us.
Andrew, do you have anything?
You know, because here's the thing. I watched, like, when I just got Showtime was, like, to watch a few different movies, you know? And, like, I watched something like, oh, yeah, this is cool. This is a really cool thing. I got to bring this up on the next podcast and tell everybody, oh, yeah, you know this thing that came out back then? You need to check it out. I can't remember what it is. I don't know what I have this sort of...
BoJack Horseman! Movie Aphasia. Season 2 available on Netflix now.
So I'm like actually clicking through, trying to look at like all of the movies that are on there, trying to figure out what was it that I said, oh yeah, that's cool, I want to talk about
was
this.
Was it Smurfs?
I think it was Smurfs. Pretty sure, Smurfs do. It was like an older, like, you know, movie from like.
Was it the Snorkels?
The Snorks. Snorks.
You know, is it like from 80s or 90s? You know, it was a film that was out, and there was a director of the film.
Transparent, season one, available now on Amazon Prime.
Boom! Ding, 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 HBO. All right, here we go. This was my Weird Things pick. Transcendence.
Transcendence?
Oh, is this the
Johnny Depp thing? Yeah, singularity thing, right?
Yeah, so this film was directed by Wally Pfister, who was the cinematographer.
I barely knew her!
What's that?
Here's a filthy joke. Keep going.
Yeah, got it. Sorry. I'm going to throw something at you there. All right. So anyhow, you know, gosh. Poor Wally. So, Transcendence is a movie that can't, you know, there was a little bit of excitement. Johnny Depp, he's going to play like a guy that uploads his consciousness to a computer system. And then, closer we got to it, you know, the trailers were like, I don't know about this. And then it came out and it did not get like great reviews. And, you know, it's like one of those, I can't wait to see this. And the closer you get to it, like, I don't know. So finally, I decided to go watch this thing. It's on HBO right now. I'm gonna watch this. Let me watch this. Let me see this for myself. And I love, like, on iTunes, like, the comments were like, there's some people who loved it. Like, if you don't like it, it's because you're just stupid. You don't get it. You don't know about it. And it's like, all right, nerds, settle down. You're, like, not real nerds anyways. You think you're smart, but you're not. That's not a way
to... If you were real nerds, you'd be checking out Weird Things every Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. Central. Am I right?
With those morons. You know, there's just that angry, like, the, you know, because, you know, people, there, some people can't live in a world where people don't like the things they like. You know, that's an amusing thing to me, is like, you know, I don't like, I like this, like, it's great. You know, I had a friend who saw a movie that I didn't like, because I liked it. I'm like, I'm glad that you liked it. You're wrong to like it, but I'm glad that you liked it. I don't mean
I'm
that they're
judging
wrong
you,
like
but I'm glad you have peace.
Yeah, so you know what? I'm going to watch this. I want to see this thing. I'm going to see this for myself. And it is the problem with the film, as I see it, is it's not really constructed well. You know, it's this thing where your things happen and all of a sudden people are acting in a way that you're like, why did we all of a sudden jump to them acting like this way and this? And it's not – it's – anyhow, that was problematic, and I think that was a big problem. But I said, you know what? Like, let me see where this goes. Let me get all the way to the end and get to the end of it and then go, okay, how would I – if I'm judging it on science fiction just in ideas, just in the idea of what I saw, how do I like it? I liked it from the idea point of view. I actually liked the idea of the film, the premise of the film and all that. I got to go, oh, cool. This wasn't what I was afraid it was going to be, you know. I don't think it was – I want to see what Pfister does next. I'm anxious to see where I hope he continues to direct and do this stuff, because he's choosing – I thought he chose a very interesting topic and a very hard topic. And we saw that with Christopher Nolan with Interstellar, which is a film that is not without its complications and stuff, but, you know, nonetheless. I would say that if you have an interest in the singularity and these other things, see Transcendence.
Okay.
Which, by the way, for those who are unaware, Wally Pfister is the longtime Christopher Nolan director of photography, and has been the.
I was saying as you were making your rude joke.
I'm sorry. But yeah, he's great, and I didn't see the movie, but I probably should.
As a matter of fact, I recently signed up for HBO Now because I cut the cord again. I really ought to do a TV show about that.
I'll be on it for you, Brian. If you do it, like, I'd go on there tomorrow if you did it.
Right on. Maybe, you know what? One of these days, we'll see.
I'd do it tomorrow, Brian. If you ask.
Okay, fine. You could be on the show tomorrow, and we'll talk about amazing cord-killing stuff. But yeah, since I cut the cord, I signed up for HBO Now, and it's funny because I signed up for HBO Now specifically for HBO originals like Game of Thrones, but it's awesome to have moments like this that you know, as I continue to watch with True Detective, that I suddenly remember, like, oh wait, they do movies too, and so I'll jump in on and I'll watch that.
Yeah, that's why, like, I jumped on the Showtime thing, because I said, you know what, like, there are a couple movies that there were there that like, ah, you know, I want to see them, but I don't want to buy. And usually I don't rent movies on online because I can't watch a movie in one sitting. Sometimes it takes me three or four sittings to make it through something. And so, you know, paying $4 a night, you know, over, I might as well. So I just buy stuff, but sometimes like, ah, I don't know if I want to buy this. And then, you know, that's what's cool about HBO and like Showtime. Like, oh, there's like three or four movies that come out a month that I want to see. And if you're getting it for like the $10 price or $12 price, well, that's worth it.
Yeah. Sure.
By the way, there is, and I'm sure you guys will talk about this on Cord Killers tomorrow, but a school of thought that like cable package bubbles because of like cord cutting. We've always this might not be an orderly, gradual kind of revolution. That there are some smart people who make the argument that this is a bubble about to burst, and these you know, companies like Showtime and HBO kind of creating their own.
You mean when you say bubble, you're referring to cable companies are the bubble, not
cable bundle and rights fees in general. Like the idea that we've seen kind of the skirmish wars over the past 5 years of networks wanting more and more, as they always have for the past 30 years per subscriber. As the pie has kind of, even as the pie has sort of contracted, we've seen, you know, those kind of fights. And now the idea of people leaving cable at a larger rate could very much exacerbate and bring, you know, a large a harsh economic reality to a lot of the major cable conglomerates. So it'll be curious.
Well, you look at right now, like Netflix had their quarterly report and they announced how many subscribers they have, and they have 60 million subscribers, and they're getting into, you know, and that's at their, I don't know what their with the $8 a month price or whatever. So
bundle, sure,
you know, yeah, you do the math on that and what they're making per month, and that's intense. I mean, that's they're grossing $480 million a month. You know, they're a $5 billion a year stream that they can then spend a good portion of that is now they're getting into developing their own original content. And what did we talk about today? You know, what shows did you guys pick?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and keep in mind also, like, I believe recently Adam Sandler did this insane, like, three-movie deal, the $80 million per movie.
Insane for who?
I mean, insane for the consumers who, yeah. I have to now, whatever. Yeah, that's the whole thing that we shouldn't talk about now.
Yeah, so anyhow, it's a very interesting time because I look at it if they're Netflix and Showtime and these things are sort of priced competitively. And I think that also it's going to start, you know, we have to start thinking about, you know, Netflix movies, the quality of the movies you get there now, there's just not a lot of great movies, but the quality of the original TV now, I think they made a very smart choice.
Unbelievable. Yeah. 100%.
Remember when Netflix was going to die because of the rights fees for movies?
Dude. And I mean, I remember on Cord Killers, like mocking Netflix for their stock valuation at the time. I forget what it was, but you know, as I went ranting off, pretending I was a coked up Reed Hastings, I remember saying, remember when we were $300 a share? Yeah, I'm Reed Hastings or whatever. It's it's amazing to see how wrong I was and how awesome the world is for it, you know?
And, you know, the really exciting thing is that, you know, given whether or not Netflix survives, which looks like they're very healthy and they will, you have Netflix and Amazon and other players getting into this game. The idea that, oh, you know what? The best content you can create now doesn't have to. I mean, like, the best shows aren't on broadcast. They're on cable.
Right.
You know, and they're getting to be more and more. They're more online. The stuff that people talk about.
This was the first year no network drama at all came from broadcast.
Holy cow.
And in fact,
for Emmy, you mean? For Emmy Awards, you mean?
Yeah.
The Emmy nominations.
For the Emmys, yeah. So you think about that. You think about that where you know, when we when was the last time we got excited about a network show that we started talking about, you know? And that's That's telling. So that's the exciting thing about Netflix. That's where the model has shifted. You know, that's where the model has shifted, and you know, we'll see.
It's funny to picture a world in which broadcast television ceased to be the dominant form, but instead became like defined by it's the safest, least ambitious of all the places. You know, whatever content you put on there has to be as safe and as milquetoast as possible.
Which is what it is. And but I'll tell you what's it's interesting too is we had recently Apple launched Beats One, right? And that's their internet radio station that's the centerpiece of the Beats network. And what's right. interesting about that, though, is the idea that as we create these little niches, you still want to have this main, this big flagpole that you can say, everybody look here, this is what's coming. Netflix, everybody knows Netflix. So if you say Daredevil Netflix, get it. You name other shows, it's confusing. The idea of still having these central sort of things, and that's going to shift. I think that's very much going to shift, but it's interesting because there is still that, like Apple saw this, you know, for music, we still want, used to be MTV, that was where you found out what was cool and new. And now they want to have like the world's number one internet radio station so they can say, hey, want to find new music? Look to here. We want to control this.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's also Beats One is so fascinating because I think it's the first radio station in history that is actively hoping that you stop listening to it and start listening to something else on Apple Music, like that, like they hope that you listen to something and you're like, man, I love that song. I want to hear that album. And then you start listening to the album and you're hooked into the Apple Music ecosphere. And that's what I actually really like about it. It's just, it's really rad to just listen to stuff and just be able to be like, yeah, I like that. I like that. I like that. And it continues to tailor the algorithm to what I like.
Yeah. To be honest, I actually think that's a brilliant strategy in that it gives you the moment you open Beats One, you feel connected to everyone else in the world. It's sort of the meta narrative is, hey, this is what the whole world is listening to. Are you with us? Yeah, we are. And then it's like, now go listen to whatever of these things you really like. I think it's important to have, you know, I mean, the role of the DJ, I remember thinking, you know, as a child born in the 70s, growing up in the 80s, I remember the voice of the DJ not being an intrusive obstruction, but instead being my connection to what music was happening, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like Beats One can absolutely do that.
Well, yeah, I agree.
You know, they there's a DJ interruption after every song. You know, they're not like you see a lot of the stuff that has been built up on commercial radio of like, hey, don't worry, you get 9 songs without listening to me. Like, here's 4 songs in a row. Or you
yeah,
don't hear
but Beats One, feel it's content though. Like they opened up with a, you know, interview with Eminem, and again, there's been other DJs doing good stuff, but so much of what we listen to on the radio now is just people trying to convince you not to go to another station and trying to feed you the commercial message and stuff.
Please
don't
hang up. I promise I won't be back soon.
Yeah, where I it's like that, you know, back in the day when, you know, we're old enough to remember radio and having that local radio station and the DJs that we like to listen to and the personalities and stuff that like, oh yeah, and here's a new thing. And that's a lot of like, you know, I listen to out in LA, I listen to a lot of, like, you know, Jack FM, which is, you know, pre-programmed, computerized, whatever, which is fun. It's a nice mix.
Like Jack FM is literally modeled on the nonsensical way a random playlist works on your iPod. That is the stated goal of Jack FM.
And absolutely. And I don't have to listen to DJs. Don't have to listen to DJs. You know, if I want to listen to, like, it used to be like in Florida, if I wanted to find something new, I'd go to the college station because I knew with the college station, they didn't care. That's like, they didn't have their general manager going, listen, if you don't keep playing the top 40s, we're going to lose our listeners. You have to do that. And that's the drive for most radio is like, listen, once you play this obscure stuff, you're going to lose 30 to 40% of the people because they don't want to hear this. They just want to hear, you know, the latest, you know, Beyonce or whatever. So that's what's kind of cool about Beats, you know, One is the idea that like, yeah, no, we're the largest company in the world paying our bill, but our goal is to get you excited about things you haven't, that novelty. So.
And that's, you know, I think there was a really interesting sequence. The first day I listened to Beats One, there's Ebro from New York plays the Kanye West Jay-Z song Otis, which has an Otis Redding sample to it, then plays the Otis Redding song that the sample is from, and then plays a song from a new artist that has a very similar sound to Otis Redding. And each time it was unstated yet explicit that, hey, do you like Jay-Z and Kanye West? Because Watch the Throne is on Apple Music. You can go ahead and listen to the rest of that. Hey, maybe you like this stuff or you're interested to be like, oh, wow, that's rad. I like the sound of that hook. Let me listen to Otis Redding. That's on Apple Music. Oh, my God. Here's my new favorite artist. I can listen to his whole album on Apple Music. It really is kind of a fascinating thing. And I think it's something that, like, I didn't see coming when they first were like, it's radio. And I'm like, whatever.
Right. Well, and definitely, and keep in mind, this is coming from somebody who has yet to experience your experience. But it seems to me like once radio is freed of all of the constraints of radio, basically, right? It's a constraint-free economy. You're not worried about how many people are listening. You're not trying to sell anything. You don't care about whether they stick around for the ads or whatever. All of a sudden, radio itself is an advertisement for the love of music. Yeah. You're able to do some astonishing things, and that's awesome.
You know whose brainchild the idea of doing? And again, internet radio's been around. It's not like people like, well, Apple's claim. Like, no,
By the way, if we can pause real quick, I have not experienced Beats One. However, I deeply, deeply, deeply adore Soma FM. If you haven't experienced it, check out any of the radio stations from Soma FM. I lost 4 years of my life of the moment in my mid-20s that I stopped knowing what the radio was playing was the moment I discovered a Secret Agent, a radio station playlist that's on the Shoutcast platform from Soma FM. It is astonishing and wonderful and amazing.
So do you know who was the one that convinced inside internally Apple we should do Beats One?
No. I guess Trent Reznor.
Yes, sir.
He just showed up.
Well, because he works with him.
He's like a product officer.
Dude, he stood there in front of the whiteboard, and there was like some image. There was he was using Keynote, and he goes, there's a chart of radio listenership, and he goes, I was up above it. And then he clicks and then he changes it. He goes, now I'm down in it.
Strobe light, yeah. And he just did this.
I just think, like, go back to high school and I had my Pretty Hate Machine t-shirt and say, you know what, that guy, lead singer, he is going to work for the Lord's largest company in the world and help them, you know, demand a divine design products, and it will feel right and natural,
dude.
Real quick too, I you know what, somebody who, like, every time she says something, I'm like, you know, she and her people are pretty smart. Taylor Swift, that letter she wrote when she was complaining about the free tier and saying that, listen, I'm taken care of, I'm covered, but a lot of these other artists, you know, these other people, if you're asking them to go, you know, 90 Dude, days without getting any compensation.
Once you let go of the idea that Taylor Swift is the actual person who's talking, once you view Taylor Swift as this amalgam of people who have all come together to create the ultimate perfect pop star, and you accept her for the beautiful cybernetic organism she is, it's amazing. As a 7-year, as the father of a 7-year old who's deeply in love with the cybernetic organism that may or may not be Taylor Swift, I think everything, like, she's batting 1,000, man. She's not getting right.
She wrote an open letter to Apple, and apparently without her label's approval, you know, it might be her, it might be her manager, who knows, because she's a very smart girl. I mean, she's
there is enough evidence to say that if that was a collaboration, that she had a very strong voice.
Of course. Absolutely. And then she's decided this is where the side she is. It was a wonderfully well written, in the sense that it was, Apple, I love you. It was not this, you guys are ruining this or this. There was no, it was classy. It was such, and I've heard people like, hey, look at the power of the internet. No, that's the power of class in the hands of a very powerful, influential person. It was a very classy letter. So if you're at Apple, you get this, you're like, this is a person I can sit down and talk to, because they're not calling me names. They're not calling us this. They're not doing this. It was this very, this is where we disagree. I know your heart's in the right place. And that's rare this time. So often it's, if we disagree, oh, it's because you're money grubbing things or whatever, you know.
Dude, it's Taylor Swift, or as I like to think of her, the T-1000, is the best.
Well, she's got a blank space, baby, and she'll write your name.
It would have been the Terminatrix, I think, from Terminator
3. Ah, Gex, right?
It's a good point.
It would have been the TX. Yeah.
What, just because she has a vagina? Right, guys, maybe she identifies as a T-800. You ever think of that? Jerk.
Sorry, Justin was busy cutting us off.
No, I was
just letting you know that I got to.
All right, we
dusty man, trail.
Let's wrap it up.
It's been after.
Good chat.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.